Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the newest edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon. I am excited to be here, as always, and once more, I've got a dream team panel to talk about one of the more interesting issues that's come up in Mormonism over the last few weeks. We are going to talk today about the discussion that sort of got going a couple of weeks ago with Warren Cole Smith, who wrote a piece on the Patheos website. For those of you who don't know what Patheos is, it's patheos.com. It's a religion portal, it's a religion website that's grown up in just the last 2 years. I kind of had actually a peek at its beginnings a couple of years ago when it was just a dream of the founders, and it's really starting to come into fruition as really an important place to go. Among other things, that it's a broad religion survey website, historical information, all sorts of things about different religions, but quite a few of the religions have their own portal, and there is a Mormon portal there that's headed up by a fellow by the name of Ben Spackman, who gets really great pieces. He's doing a great job leading that portal, but anyway, this discussion by Warren Cole Smith came up in one of the other portals on it, and it basically is an article that says a vote for Romney, meaning Mitt Romney, is a vote for the LDS Church. And then this Warren Cole Smith goes on and names not only Mormonism as a false religion, but also a dangerous religion. And so that caught a lot of people's attention. He did a follow-up interview on Patheos as well. But then our own Joanna Brooks, who is one of our panelists today again, and we're so grateful to have Joanna, she had an interview with him and sort of got things buzzing in sort of this Mormon Stories, Mormon Matters podcast community. So we're excited to talk about that moment of this article, and I want to really thank a couple of listeners, Greg Payette and Michael Todd, who immediately after this happened wrote in and says, we need to have a show on this. And I sense that even though Mormonism and evangelical Christianity and Mormonism and mainstream Christianity, even though the differences have been outlined before, I really think it would be good to explore just the feel and the flavor of these two traditions, why there is this hesitation by many Christians to accept Mormons within the Mormon fold. And for that, for helping us with that, I've gotten two other fantastic panelists, Jana Reese, and we'll explain a little bit about her background and why she is perfectly positioned to this, as well as a good friend of mine, John Moorhead, who does great interfaith work here in Utah and has a real good sense of both traditions. And I'll let them introduce themselves here in a second. So why don't I just stop, and then I'll do another little framing as we dive in. But Joanna Brooks, welcome back. Can you remind our listeners or those who are hearing you for the first time a little bit about you?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I am a permablogger at Feminist Mormon Housewives with my Ask Mormon Girl column, and I also have a column about three times a week at religiondispatches.org. And I'm always happy to be on Mormon Matters.
We love having you. I know it's going to it's going to be a good panel whenever Joanna's on, because you're just so fun, and we had a great time seeing you in person this weekend at the Mormon Stories Conference, and maybe a moment or two of that will come up as we talk today. But if not, I'm sure it'll come up in there's great pictures of Joanna in her pioneer bonnet that are out there.
And on Facebook?
And you know what? I even submitted to putting the bonnet on myself, and so I'm sure that picture will show up and embarrass me soon. But
you know, we Mormons must learn to wear our bonnets with pride.
There you go. Anyway, Jana Reese, you've been on our podcast before, but for those who haven't met you, or if this is the first time they're listening in, can you give us a quick background about, introduce yourself quickly? Thanks.
Sure. Well, it's A pleasure to be back. And unfortunately, I am bonnetless today. I just didn't know that would be required. So rats.
Well, the theme of that conference was open Mormon pioneers. And so Joanna just took it literally and brought her Trek bonnet or whatever it was.
Joanna, do you have a bonnet?
I have no bonnet.
Oh, okay. Okay, it's on the to-do list. Every Mormon deserves a bonnet.
Maybe a Mormon out there listening can sew one for me. That would be so.
I will commission one.
Oh, excellent. All right. Yeah. Well, okay, I'm supposed to tell you who I am. I'm also a permablogger for beliefnet.com. I cover Mormonism once a week and other things on the other days. And I'm the author of several books, including Flunking Sainthood, which is coming out in November.
Hooray!
Yes, and that is also the name of your blog at BeliefNet, right? And do you want to keep people like a 10 or 15 second explanation of what that title means?
Oh, well, it's a book about spiritual failure and the humor of spiritual failure. It is at least allegedly a humor book. And so that's what I'm most interested in. I'm interested in imperfection. I'm interested in people who are fighting the good fight, trying to endure to the end. But sometimes we fall short.
Great. Now, you haven't mentioned this, so let me go ahead and do it. Two of the reasons, really, that I've asked you to be on here, and I'm so grateful that you've joined, is your own spiritual autobiography had you in the trajectory of becoming an ordained minister in a Christian tradition. It was actually, weren't you in seminary when you converted to Mormonism?
Yes, which is not necessarily the traditional path for people. Princeton Seminary. So yes, I joined the Mormon Church while I was a student in seminary and while I was on the path toward ordination in the Presbyterian Church. I should emphasize here that although I have theological training, I am not a professional theologian. I don't even play one on TV. So whatever I say here today is my opinion and my understanding of our faith and of the evangelical tradition as well, and not necessarily doctrine.
Very good. Thanks for that. Now, the other reason, besides your own journey, for 7 or 8 years, you were the religion book editor for Publishers Weekly. So you had hundreds of religion books come your way. Every month, just more and more and more. And you were in charge of sort of selecting which ones would get reviewed by Publishers Weekly. I know you did a lot of the reviews yourself. And so my sense is you have a real good sense of Christian publishing and the types of voices that are out there. And I know you talk about Christian publishing even today still on your Flunking Sainthood blog.
Yeah, you know, I spent 9 years at Publishers Weekly. I'd love to say that I did most of the reviews myself, Dan, but you have an inflated view of my talents.
Well, I know you didn't do most, but you did some, right?
I did some.
Yeah.
But yeah, 9 years at PW, and I now work for Westminster John Knox Press, which is the publishing arm, sort of the Presbyterian Church. We are a nonprofit, and we are self-sustaining, so not supported by the church. But, you know, I'm around Protestantism all the time, and my husband is also Protestant. My daughter is Protestant, and so I have maybe a different perspective than many Mormons might have.
Great. Well, we want you to bring all of yourselves to this conversation. John, would you tell us a little bit more about your locale and your background and your training and some of the different things that you're doing about this dialogue to begin with, and just whatever you'd like to share?
And do it all in 30 seconds. No pressure.
Right. And for those who wanted to remind you, your name's John Moorhead. I said it too long ago, but John Moorhead.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I appreciate it. And looking forward to our conversation. I'm the director of the Western Institute for Intercultural Studies. I'm an evangelical, albeit, I think, a different kind of evangelical. Some of my thoughts in this dialogue will bear out. I am a scholar in new religions, and I specialize in Mormon studies and pagan studies, and I also have an interest in religion and popular culture, and I'm involved in interreligious dialogue. I do some work with you, Dan, and Charles Randy Paul, and the Foundation for Religious Diplomacy, and I have been a reorganized Latter-day Saint in years past, and have some understanding of Mormon culture and also evangelical culture, and hopefully I'll be able to share some insights that might be good for your listeners today.
Great, and we're looking forward to that. And anytime there's going to be times I'm going to ask you to sort of represent these, what you would consider the, you know, mainstream evangelical voice, and then whenever you want to say, but I differ a little bit here or there, please feel free to do that. But I'd love to have you make that as clear as possible when you're sort of teaching us
So, I'll do my best.
All right. Exciting. All right, Joanna, you kind of started this. You got the thing going here with this Warren Cole Smith article that obviously caught your attention. And I don't know if you tell us about the emotions that kind of came over you when you heard this argument and that led you to giving him a call and interviewing him and putting that out there. Why don't you kind of just get us going with, you know, in all this, you'll be able to tell us a little bit about some of his main theses and the reasons that you wanted to engage him.
Right. And, you know, let me just give a little background that will help people understand, you know, my own reactions and motivations coming into this. I mean, as, you know, I grew up in Southern California in the 1980s. You know, I grew up in a sizable Mormon community. But Southern California and especially Orange County, where I grew up, was also home to some of the first evangelical mega churches. And when I was in junior high and high school, those were the years when the film The Godmakers, the anti-Mormon film The Godmakers, was produced, and an active sort of anti-Mormon missionizing was taking place among evangelical Christians. And a lot of it happened in the area where I lived. There was an outfit called Ex-Mormons for Jesus that was headquartered basically in my hometown. So, you know, folks would picket our state conferences. The churches, like, and pretty mainline Presbyterian churches even, that my friends went to, they would screen the Godmakers, they would hold up Mormon undergarments during kind of meetings and you know, display them and ridicule them. I got notes taped to my locker, things written in my yearbook, and, you know, my best friend in high school wrote her junior term paper on Mormons being a cult. You know, so, hoity-ho-ho.
Ouch. Wow.
You know, I mean, so, you know, and there would be these odd kinds of events, you know, like youth outreach events that some of the evangelical mega churches would host, you know, and our friends would invite us, Mormon kids, and we'd go kind of like sheep in there. And, you know, they play rock and roll music and serve pizza on paper plates. And then some comic would come on stage and after doing 5 minutes of really bad comedy would launch into a 10-minute diatribe about how Mormonism is a cult, you know. And so we just kept wandering into these. You know, as a Mormon youth in Orange County in the 1980s, I experienced my fair share of anti-Mormonism, and, you know, and it made me cry. And I never understood what the point was, because it really didn't feel like any of it was being designed to save me from my errant beliefs. Well, okay, fast forward 30 years, or not 30, 25 years, 20 years. Yeah, how old am I? No, yeah, I forget. It's been a long weekend of Mormon stories. But anyway, fast forward to 2011. And, you know, we've seen anti-Mormon or evangelical objections to Mormonism, you know, in the press throughout the intervening years. And with Romney, the run-up to Romney's presidential candidacy again, you know, and as someone who writes for Religion Dispatch, as I was watching, increasing traffic on the topic of Mormon beliefs and their idiosyncrasy. And Patheos published a suite of articles about Mormonism and Romney. And, you know, two of them at least were from evangelical identified authors who expressed support for Mitt Romney or made a case for a neutral approach to Romney's Mormonism. But the article that got the most interest, at least in LDS communities, was one by an evangelical Christian publisher who is the associate publisher of a very large circulation magazine called The World that serves evangelical audiences, published an essay in that Patheos suite that said, "A vote for Romney is a vote for the LDS Church." And in it, he made the most forthright case for why evangelical Christians would and should object to a Romney presidency. And I read the piece as soon as it was published, and I set it aside. It seemed fairly familiar to me, both in its aggressive tone and in some of the desire to expose or ridicule or criticize elements of Mormon belief. And I wasn't really that interested in engaging it because I didn't know what good would come of it. A friend of mine who works as a religion journalist contacted me and said, "Well, you know, I know him, and would you like me to set up a conversation?" And I said, "Well, yeah, sure. You know, maybe something productive could happen in a conversation, you know, because when I write, I don't try and just, I try, when I write for Religion Dispatches, I try not to just poke wounds. I try to go somewhere with what I write. So yay. I said, well, yeah. And so I said, well, that would be great. And so reading over the article again, I really, and I'm preparing to speak with him, and he very graciously agreed to speak with me on the phone from his home. And reading over his article again, I drew up a list of questions that I sent him in advance, and my goal was to try to elucidate his point of view a little better. You know, as someone who's lived with anti-Mormonism for, you know, her whole life and for whom it played a significant role in my childhood, I have a curiosity to understand why. I mean, I remember being 13 years old and driving by the Presbyterian church where, you know, the billboard read out front, Mormons, Christian, or cult, and crying and asking my mom, why? Why do they care? And her answer was, you know, kind of a standard Orthodox answer was, well, you know, we're making a lot of converts and they're threatened by us. And that never sat right with me. And so my goal in speaking with Warren Smith was to try to come to understand better the worldview that would identify Mormonism as a particular problem in a candidate and in just a believing person. And so I sent him in advance pretty much the list of questions that appear in the article at Religion Dispatches, and then, you know, had a conversation with him on the telephone, my house, his house, and Friday morning a few weeks ago. And it was a spirited conversation. He was very forthright. One thing, and you can read the entirety of it on Religion Dispatches.
And I'll link to it for sure.
Yeah. And I opened it, you know, with his claim, you know, Mormonism is false and dangerous. And I tried to press him on, you know, what does it mean for a religion to be dangerous? Is any religion that's not an evangelical Christianity dangerous? And, you know, and we continued through it. And it became clear to me, one of the things that was fascinating to me that I learned from the article, I mean, from the experience of interviewing Warren Smith, was I think Warren was prepared for me to approach the conversation in the way that the institutional LDS church has often approached the conversation with evangelicals, which is to say, oh, we're just like you. We're just like you. We're just like you. And I was coming at it from a different, and I'd say, a more liberal approach, which is, of course we're different. Of course we're different.
But why is it dangerous?
Why is difference harmful, dangerous? And, you know, and at one point he even said to me, look, you know, if you believe just like us, why don't you just join the Baptist church? I said, well, I like being Mormon. You know, I don't want to join the Baptist church. I mean, I have Baptist friends and, you know, I respect Baptist tradition, but I'm Mormon. So, you know, I'll let folks read for themselves. But, you know, I was forthright. He was forthright. You know, the conversation, I experienced a lot of adrenaline as I was having the conversation. I was writing on Facebook, kind of like blowing off steam while I was interviewing him. And I said, oh, my hands are shaking. You know? But I hope it was a productive conversation. I love the fact that the conversation we're looking forward to having today is about better understanding differences between evangelical Christians and Mormons. Because I don't like to just, I don't like to frame this exchange in terms of affirming a Mormon persecution complex. I don't think that's very useful. I do think it's useful for us to understand evangelical Christian point of views better. And recognizing that the point of view articulated by Warren Smith is in the minority of evangelical Christian perspective. The Pew survey that came out a few weeks ago indicated that, you know, about a third of evangelical Christians would not vote for a Mormon president. That's a third. You know, two-thirds of evangelical Christians do not feel this way. Two-thirds of the articles by evangelical Christians posted at Patheos do not, you know, take this tack that Mormonism is dangerous or that one should object to a Romney presidency because of Romney's Mormonism. So, you know, in understanding that one-third of evangelical Christians and having a clarifying dialogue that will hopefully move us towards a pluralistic and accepting place, if it's possible. So that's some background.
Very good. I want to get Joanna and John to jump in about the Warren Cole Smith piece and Joanna's interview, if you'd like, and then whatever you guys don't like raise in just in your comments and the emphases. I do have a few more things that I do want to clarify about some of his actual reasons that he says Mormonism are dangerous. But why don't I turn the time over to either one of you to kind of jump in and react to what Joanna has just kind of framed for us in the articles itself. Go first, well, whoever speaks. Jana, you're in.
And jump in and say, the article really ticked me off. And, you know, actually, I'm not that person, typically, the one who is the knee-jerk reaction when Mormonism is attacked. I'm usually fine with that. It's just so expected. But a couple of things about this article were incendiary. One of them, and I know evangelicals who would disagree with this, he claims that all evangelicals are inerrantists about the Bible. And that's not true. You know, he is caricaturing his own tribe as much as he is caricaturing Mormonism. So that's a problem. But I think also he has this idea that is straight from the Reed Smoot trials in the early 20th century,
right,
that inevitably a Mormon is going to answer first to the LDS Church and only in a secondary or tertiary way to the needs of the nation. And he also says that if the beliefs are false, then the behavior will eventually, but inevitably, be warped.
Can I follow up on that, Jana? Because that's a really brilliant observation about Warren's approach, and something that people comment, I received mail about the interview afterwards, saying he seemed to think that Mormon behavior was always going to be unreliable. I said to him, there's no evidence the church is invested in the Romney campaign. You know, like, there's no evidence that the church is going to tell 19-year-old missionaries to carry a picture of a President Romney around the world. In fact, I'm pretty sure they're not going to, if you know anything about how Mormon missionaries are trained. And he said they're prevaricating. They're not true. Go ahead.
No, I'm just being sarcastic. You know, he said there are hundreds of thousands of Mormon missionaries around the world, which is such a gross exaggeration. It doesn't completely not true. There are currently 50,000 Mormon missionaries serving around the world. And if he cared enough to do the slightest bit of research about the church today, he would know that.
It just seemed to be, there seemed to be a thread, like you're saying, though, Jana, that if the beliefs are, quote, false, then the behavior will be so. And so everything in his worldview of Mormonism appeared to be suspect. Of course, the church isn't telling the truth. Of course, the truth is the church is gaming on a Romney presidency because that's what Mormons do. They're false. Of course, Romney says he won't use the office to speak about his faith, even though no president has used the office to showcase particulars of a faith, except for arguably George Bush with some of the neoconservative foreign policy. But of course, you know, Romney is going to slip it in there. Like, we're all prevaricators of some kind because our beliefs are idiosyncratic. That's a thread that you picked up on, Jana, that other readers picked up on as well.
Cool. Now, just, Jana, I want you to continue, and then we definitely want to get John in here. But I wanted to make the connection for the missionaries there because you guys were just sort of, you know, the article. One of his arguments for listeners who haven't read it is that having a Mormon president simply normalizes Mormonism. In other words, just the fact that somebody could be Mormon and accepted enough to be the president of the United States takes sort of the weirdness factor away and the danger factor away, at least from some people's mind, and it normalizes it. And so his idea was that Mormon missionaries would for sure jump on this. Let me tell you about the religion of the U.S. president. You know, it's easier to say it's not weird if we have a president of the United States who's from that faith tradition. So I just wanted to clarify that that's what that argument was about.
Well, there are a lot of problems with this article. Another one is the way he harps on the idea of continuing revelation as a theological tenet of Mormonism.
Right.
Fair enough. I think it's perfectly legitimate for an evangelical to claim that an idea of continuing revelation is extra-biblical, or to claim that it is not in conjunction with the Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed, or any of the major creeds that are traditionally accepted by mainstream Christianity. However, that's not what he says. He thinks that the idea of continuing revelation is dangerous to the United States presidency. Wait for it. Because a president might change his mind. Oh, no. You know, if that had been such a problem, LBJ would have been a segregationist all of his life. It's ridiculous.
Yep, that was definitely an interesting angle. And then there's the final angle that was so strange about Mormons have such a weird view of the history of the United States with Jesus coming here and where the Garden of Eden, I mean, I don't know, if, I can't remember how much he actually brought into it, but this idea that we ought to at least have a president that sees the same history of this country as everybody else does. And as a Mormon, he naturally sees things within the history of the United States that are false. And it was a strange argument.
Last 2 weeks, Sarah Palin has been making up American history as she goes along. Nope. Mormons do not have a monopoly on the fabrication of history.
Well, and, you know, when I was responding to that point, you know, I am someone who has sort of bracketed a literal belief in some, not all, in some very specific historical claims while remaining a believing Mormon. And I said that to him. I said, well, you know, that's really not the core of Mormon messaging today. You could listen to General Conference, you know, wall to wall for the last 5 years and not hear anyone talk about, you know, the Garden of Eden being in Missouri. You know, I mean, come on. People love to cherry pick this stuff out of the religion. And meanwhile, most Mormons around the world are on a freight train towards the doctrine of the family, the plan of happiness. You know, like, this is a part of our Mormon heritage. You know, and he was not prepared for an LDS person to view LDS history and theology with any kind of nuance. You know, saying, look, you know, the core of a tradition's messaging, the core of a tradition's theology can be different from the entirety, you know, from the details of the belief tradition. So it was a very interesting yeah. take of his. Yeah.
Yeah. And I do want to steer us away from the Warren Colesmith piece as soon as we can, but John, I want to get your take. Do you have anything about his positions or Joanna's interview or anything like that that you wanted to offer before we sort of move more into really the meat of this discussion today? What we're talking about here is just the jumping off point, but is there any thoughts that you have there that we could draw out of you right now?
Yeah, I suppose I had two major general concerns. I appreciate all the specific concerns that have been shared, but as an evangelical, as I read his article, I too was angered and disappointed but not surprised to see that kind of position articulated by a prominent evangelical. To me, number one, it was a reminder that we still have a significant expression in evangelical culture of viewing Mormonism and other new religious movements as a cult. And yeah. This creates something of a defensive kind of mindset. Thankfully, there is an evangelicalism for several years now. A change on the part of younger evangelicals who have moved away from that kind of understanding, or certainly they downplay it, which is why you see a decline in the influence of counter-cult ministries like those that produced the Godmakers in years past.
Right.
And secondly, I think another thing that was concerning was that we have another example of the fact that Protestant evangelicals have a tough time living in a post-Christendom pluralistic America.
Right.
I don't think it's post-Christian, but I think it's post-Christendom in that while numerically evangelicalism continues to do well in this country, nevertheless, the church is suspect as an institution and it doesn't define the center of American discourse. And I think many evangelicals have a tough time with that. And when you have concerns over whether it's Barack Obama and him allegedly taking us away from an American vision of the past, or the potential of having a Mormon president, I think those kinds of things reinforce the fears of the loss of a defining center for Christendom and the culture.
Those are great points. Thank you.
Amazing.
Jana, did I cut you off on any more gut reactions on the Warren Colesmith thing, or
Dan,
are we ready to move on?
It's a blessing because... I need to let it go. So exactly the right thing.
Happy to serve. Just all right. Well, here now let's really move in and let's spend a good half hour, as we can here on the differences between evangelicals and Mormons, worldview, etc., mostly concentrating on understanding the evangelical worldview. And I do want to do some. Quick distinctiveness from mainstream Christianity. So either Jana and John, I'll start with John and then ask Jana to add in her perspectives as sort of a, you know, you both can be good bridge builders for us. But John, would you articulate for just a couple of minutes what makes somebody an evangelical Christian versus one of the more mainstream, you know, Protestant sort of thing? So if you don't mind, just a quick thing on what makes an evangelical Christian. What are the things that they hang their hat on that are maybe a little bit different than mainstream?
Well, just for, on my part, a little terminology clarification. By mainstream, do you mean mainline? Christianity.
Absolutely, you're right, because mainstream can be within any of the side groups. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, so mainline.
In American Christianity, it's certainly mainstream to some extent, but it's different from mainline, like PCUSA and Protestantism and those kinds of things.
Good, that's what I meant, mainline.
Evangelicalism is extremely difficult to define to everybody or anybody's satisfaction, but it tends to put great value on the literal truth of the Bible, on a personal salvation experience, on fidelity to certain what they would consider doctrinal essentials, on truth as being important, on personal evangelism. And I think one of the interesting factors that is at play here, I was at an inter-religious dialogue conference a few years ago, and Craig Hazen of Biola University brought up an interesting point. He says one of the challenges between evangelicals and Mormons is what he called a disparity of concern, and that is in terms of, for an evangelical who puts a lot of concern over doctrinal truth with a capital T, when they encounter a Mormon who they see as believing in a false religion, for them, that has eternally weighty consequences for their salvation. And many times there is such a great zeal on the part of the evangelical that they put so many eggs in the basket of personal salvation that they lose sight of broader considerations like interpersonal relations and viewing the person not just as a religious other and so on. And so I think a lot of important issues like politics in the public square get lost and swallowed up because of that disparity of concern.
Terrific. That helps a lot. Jana, would mm-hmm. you like to add anything there, especially maybe coming from the mainline thing looking at evangelicalism? What do you sort of share, but maybe just emphasize differently, or are there things that a lot of mainline churches would say everything that John said, you know, any of the things that John said, those are completely out. They're not even factors for us. I sense that there's overlap, you know, on all of those. But
I think that for Mormon listeners, one of the key things, you know, you've alluded to this difference between mainline Protestantism and evangelical Protestantism, and it would be helpful, I think, to explain that a little bit more. Mm-hmm. As John has said, evangelicalism is very diverse, and it's very difficult to pin down. You know, we talked about this article that was in The World. Well, The World is one of the most conservative evangelical publications, but there are many other evangelical publications that wouldn't take that tack, and they're still under that rubric. Okay, so that's one point. Mainline Protestantism, as you said, it would be some of those kind of old school Protestant denominations, such as PC, Presbyterian Church of the USA, or in some places, the Methodist Church, and in some places, that would be considered more evangelical. And I think that for those churches, Episcopal Church would certainly be in the mainline. For many of those mainline denominations, missionary work has become less important than it is to many evangelicals. And missionary work among evangelicals continues to be important. That's one important distinction within Protestantism. Going way back, though, both groups within Protestantism share something that's really important in trying to understand the difference between Protestantism and Mormonism, which is the emphasis on sola scriptura and the emphasis on sola fide. So sola scriptura, sola fide, those are terms from the Reformation, and it means scripture alone and faith alone, so that you don't add to scripture, which Mormons have done repeatedly and probably will continue to do in the future. So that's, you know, that's something that evangelicals have a very difficult time understanding. Sola fide, I'd like to talk a little bit more about, because I have a strong feeling about how evangelicals regard Mormon ideas of salvation. And sometimes I think that those ideas may be a bit of a caricature of Mormon theology.
Okay, do you want to go into it right now?
Sure.
I don't know a natural place to. Oh, John, do you want to jump in with the sola fide versus how evangelicals would see Mormons not relying on faith alone and being more of a works orientation or a de-emphasizing grace for their own merit?
Yeah, I certainly think that continues to be a major point of contention between the evangelicals and Latter-day Saints. I think it's interesting, you have seen in some of these public dialogues between representatives of the two traditions almost an attempt to come together to articulate that perhaps they're not quite so far away. I'm thinking here of Bob Millett and Greg Johnson and some of their dialogues. However, for many evangelicals, in their view, the Mormon position is still unacceptable. They still see it as a system of works-based kind of religion, and therefore it would as a system be false. And even if that issue was resolved, when you get to things like Trinitarian theology and so on, there are a number of significant areas where evangelicals and Latter-day Saints are still going to reach an impasse. So the divide is still very wide.
John, right. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Because this was something I tried to kind of push and understand a little bit more when I was talking to Warren. And so I can understand, I mean, you know, let's be frank, Mormons also believe that other religions, well, some Mormons also believe that other religions are false, right? So it's not fair for Mormons to take offense just at the idea that someone else thinks our religion's false because we dish it out all the time.
Right.
But I was trying to pressure him on the idea of dangerous and understand the particular tone and intensity of falsehood, falseness ascribed to Mormonism. So I ran him through some questions. Well, help me understand, is Judaism false and dangerous? Is Catholicism false and dangerous? He said, no. You know, he was pretty cool with any religion that subscribed to the Nicene Creed. And I pressed him a little further. I said, is there any other religion in America today or in the world today that you would call, you know, false and dangerous? And I sensed that there might be a few others that he would name, but he didn't want to, you know, dig a hole for himself, which I totally understand. But so, you know, from a perspective like a conservative evangelical perspective like Warren Smith, you know, for example, would a Jehovah's Witnesses be a false and dangerous religion because they proselytize and have idiosyncratic views? I mean, I'm asking this very neutrally, just to understand, are we the only ones that merit this sort of adjective, or do we have a club?
Well, it's been a few years since I traveled in these kinds of circles, but I still think I have my finger on the pulse of where they're coming from. I think for many evangelicals, the concern about Mormonism is if there was greater distance, if it didn't present itself in some sense as Christian, if it didn't lay claim to the Bible and so on, if there was greater religious and cultural distance between the two, I don't think it would be as threatening and as much of a concern. But because there is this proximity between the two traditions, I think for evangelicals, this is part of why they consider it false and dangerous. But there are other groups. In the past, in the counter-cult community, there used to be what I call the big three that they used to focus on. And it was based upon perception of threat, I think. And it was Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, and at that time, the New Age movement.
Interesting. Okay, that's what I thought.
New Age having become more mainstream and less wearing the label New Age, there are shifting targets and fear, if you will. I think many evangelicals today, and even beyond the evangelical movement, would look perhaps at Islam as a false and dangerous religious movement. So so danger is defined in differing ways depending upon what particular group they're looking at.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I definitely want to keep in this area, but I don't want to make this thought take us away, but are you basically saying that if Mormonism weren't in its current trajectory or its current strategy of, you know, really, there's not that much difference. We're a lot like you guys. In other words, if we had pushed our ideological or theological differences more, there wouldn't be this sort of fox in the hen house kind of you're sneaking in here, wolf in sheep's clothing kind of thing that is causing the animosity against Mormonism. If we really had clearly distinguished ourselves more as a part.
I think so. If you look at the relationship historically between Christianity and Judaism, there was greater tension in the past when they had closer proximity. But over time, as Christianity has distinguished itself as a separate religious tradition, related but separate, the tension has gone down somewhat, as long as no persecution is taking place. I think if a similar type of thing were to happen, if Mormonism were to make the decision as an entity that we are going to emphasize our distinctiveness, that we have a relationship to historic Protestantism, but nevertheless, we are a distinct and very different religious tradition. I think some of that perception of threat and some of the perception of fear, at least, and danger would be minimized, even though they would still consider it a false religious tradition.
And right. If I can just add one thing, that's really fascinating to a liberal Mormon like me, because there's a general perception among, you know, liberal Mormons that over the last 20 years, there was an over effort. Well, there's absolute documentable truth in this, but also you know, some things we've suspected that the church has, in service of a missionary agenda, tried to de-emphasize differences and emphasize similarities, including conservative political stances, in order to make common cause with and win over converts from evangelicalism. And, you know, some liberal and gay and lesbian Mormons have felt that that's one of the reasons they've been, you know, so vocal and involved on gay issues, and as well as punishing people who tend to talk about or study or explore some of the unique aspects of Mormon history. So that's a really fascinating perspective to me.
Yeah, I'm really pleased. Thank you so much, John, on that. And I'm just going to put it out there to listeners, and if you want to react in the comments, I kind of want to have a podcast here in the next few weeks about Mormon distinctiveness and whether or not we're exactly like this trend that has led us to this point, perhaps where a Mormon could be considered to become president. So maybe it would be hard to say that the results haven't worked out in terms of normalizing us and making us feel a little bit less exotic, but on the other hand, I'm kind of interested in seeing what we could do if we really would push our differences. So I'll just put that out there right now. Now, John, here's the transition I want to make now, and Jan, I would definitely want you in here too. We're dangerous, and there's this piece of it is we're dangerous because we could help, we would lead people to lose their salvation. And so when you say that if Mormonism were to move away a little bit from its, hey, we're just like you guys, maybe we'd be less of a target of evangelicals, just the way evangelicals aren't really targeting Jews and others who, you know, they're not, I don't know, maybe they are, I'm just not aware of it. But if it's the salvation thing, why isn't everybody getting the same treatment? You know, you're going to lose your salvation. It's out of love, I'm supposing, at least that's the self-talk among evangelical Christians. It's out of our love for you that we want to save you from false doctrines and false beliefs that will eventually lead to the false behaviors of sin and whatnot. So why are we dangerous and Jews aren't dangerous? Because don't those Jewish souls deserve salvation too?
Are you asking me for some clarification on that?
Just the salvation piece sort of always gets me here because, you know, anything false is apparently in danger to everybody's salvation. So I think, why Jews, why Muslims, why aren't evangelicals as worried about our souls?
Well, I think it goes back again to what I mentioned a bit ago, is that there is the perception that Mormonism is a wolf in sheep's clothing. It presents itself as Christianity when in fact it's something very other, and therefore it's false and dangerous.
And dangerous because you're pulling us out of true believing Christianity?
Right.
Okay, but it's not...
Right.
It's,
and because you're proselytizing from us rather than just kind of throwing your net across a wider spectrum of the society. So there is this, and I think we need to, I appreciate the honesty in this, and that both Mormons and evangelicals have considered each other false. We disagree with our doctrine. We both view each other in some senses as good sources for evangelism across our religious cultures. We need to acknowledge that. But yeah, at the same time, I think we need to also be fair in how we characterize each other. So, for example, I mentioned earlier, in evangelicalism, you do have this movement that has moved away from viewing Mormonism and other new religions as a cult and instead are calling to view them as a religious culture. And giving the same kind of respect and trying to communicate your concerns of what you understand the gospel to be in ways that make sense in that religious culture, rather than constantly pointing out what you consider to be the bad news of Mormonism. So I am hopeful in that there is a change going on in evangelicalism, even though we do have folks like Mr. Smith who are continuing to present kind of an older, more 80s kind of approach to dealing with Mormonism.
Cool. Jana, anything to jump in with?
Well, I think that John is absolutely right. There are very important theological differences between Mormonism and evangelical Christianity, and those definitely play a part in terms of the passion with which many evangelicals want to disprove Mormonism. But I would also add that there are clear sociological factors at work here. You know, as a historian, I did some work into Christian Science at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th mm-hmm. century. And it's instructive for me to look back at the pamphlets the agonizing sense that evangelical Christians had at that time, that Christian Science was the viper on the hearth, the wolf in sheep's clothing. It was calling itself Christian, which is terrible because it's not Christian and it's headed by a woman. And, you know, there are all these problems with it theologically. You never hear about evangelicals who are protesting Christian Science anymore. Why not? Because Christian Science is dying, unfortunately. Mormonism is a vital, growing religion with a high proportion of youth. And as John has said, many of our converts come from the already churched rather than the unchurched. And that creates tension after tension.
So you guys are saying my mom was right?
I was thinking the same thing.
Well, you know, when you said that, I was thinking there's a lot of truth in what she said. I think what bothers me when Mormons are sort of theologizing about all of this opposition and they say, well, it's just one more proof that we're the true church because people are opposing us. And, oh, gosh, that just gets me really riled.
Well,
it's
also,
so theologically naive.
And also the idea that we're the only minority religion that has been so abused ever.
Yes.
Well, I do think there's something of an irony going on here in that while evangelicals constantly point to what they consider the threat of the Mormon missionary force, you know, whether 50 or 60,000 missionaries, I think the best social science research points out that actually, comparatively speaking, very little converts come through that particular source, but rather it's through relationships, right. Which is what Christianity historically has always been about and where they see their growth. So, again, they're looking at what's going on, the phenomenon, through a skewed perception of threat. And because of that, even though I sincerely believe that Mr. Smith and many other evangelicals do sincerely care for sharing their message to Latter-day Saints, the manner in which they go about it, because it is largely through the perception of threat and fear, it simply comes across as anti-Mormon, anything but loving.
That was one thing I noticed in our conversation, too. I wanted... I felt, you know, and I'm not sure that all of this nuance got captured in what I was able to write online, but, you know, he made the conversation very much about me. So, you know, well, Joanna, if someone were to tell you this, wouldn't you believe that? That kind of a tone. And I felt during the conversation that there was a missionizing happening right there. And I understand that as an expression, a general expression of a commitment to an evangelical worldview and as love and concern in its own way. But the tone is so distinctive, you know, like, don't rescue me, please, from anything I really love. I'm okay, you know. Can we be pluralist?
John had pointed to something that I think is really important here, which is that the dialogue is changing. And some
it
of
is.
The anger and the vitriol that we've seen on both sides is softening, partly because of Mormons moving out of their own enclave and daring to be part of the world, and partly because some scholars and other thinkers have taken the initiative in forming partnerships to talk about this formally and informally. Several books have come out of those conversations, including that if I could recommend it, two, okay? One is called How Wide the Divide, An Evangelical and a Mormon in Conversation. This was published about 14 years ago by InterVarsity Press, which is an evangelical press. And one of my closest friends is the publisher at IVP. And he shared with me some of the nasty letters that they got from evangelicals, you know, not the letters themselves, but just the fact that they had received them. People who were very angry, but they stuck to their guns, published the book, and it helped to thaw. It helped to at least open the channels of conversation. Another one is, more recently, Claiming Christ, a Mormon Evangelical Debate. That's Bob Millett and Gerald McDermott. So you have a Mormon and an evangelical in conversation, and it's deeply theological. It's a challenging book in terms of explaining some of these differences, but it's really rewarding for people who are interested.
Good. And I want to spend a few minutes just hitting a couple of those theological pieces, but then I really want to just move away from that. So, in other words, we could go forever, you know, on just the differences in doctrines and views of God and the typical things that evangelicals will say that, you know, that lead people to say you worship a different Jesus than us. So I do want to touch on that, but I also want to just kind of get into more of the mentality a little bit. I thought, John, your bit about mainline Christianity, and then you said Christendom you used, the sort of idea that the center of the values of the United States were at one, they were Protestant at one time, and now they're not, and things like that. So I want to kind of get into the sort of the general lived mentality that's sort of a little bit less doctrinally focused. But if you don't mind, John, one of the things that Warren Cole Smith kept talking about in both his piece as well as Joanna's interview is the Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed. Catholics are okay because they still affirm that view of God. That, to him, is a biblical view of God, and he considers that essential or saving doctrine. You need to have that sort of thing. Can you help us understand how, you know, at least from Mormon perspective, how this creed that emerges 3 centuries after, you know, Jesus' life and death came to represent for Christianity just this pure, absolutely essential thing that people have to assent to?
Well, it's interesting. I'm pleased to hear him say that he's willing to accept Catholics. He left the Orthodox out of there, but I think
he actually, in his follow-up interview, so there was his initial article, Joanna's interview, and then there's another one, Patheos, where he did actually bring in Orthodox. So
That's good. I mean, in years past, Philip Jenkins has written about that. You know, there was a strong anti-Catholic sense amongst Protestants, and perhaps that has softened, at least when a new perceived threat is presented in terms of Mormonism and a Romney candidacy. But somehow over the course of the centuries, you know the history, and many of our listeners do as well, it took a number of centuries of thought and reflection, theological and philosophical and so on, for the church to hammer out her Trinitarian theology, her various creeds. And somehow along the way, over the course of history for evangelicals, these have become kind of summaries as to what one must affirm in order to be Orthodox.
But
I think so. Would move beyond that and say also to be saved, which is fascinating to me because I've gotten myself into some trouble in evangelical circles as I revisit the New Testament. It seems to me that we don't see this kind of thing there. You see what I call a doctrinal minimalism, that what is required is very simply a faith in Jesus Christ. I don't think many New Testament Christians or in the first few centuries had a whole lot of depth in their theological understanding. And I think if you were to ask many evangelicals to define Trinitarian theology or the Nicene Creed or what have you, they couldn't do it. So they are asking,
okay, good.
They're asking of the theological other things that they can't maintain themselves. And for whatever reason, it has become a kind of a boundary for defining who's in and who's out of authentic Christianity.
Good, good. So, John, you're saying there's not a whole lot of examination of how this got enthroned. You are among people who do it. Is there a trend that this is, I mean, the wider evangelical movement versus the Warren Cole Smith kind of branch of it or something like that? Is there a lot of people that are saying, are aiming more towards this minimalism that you're talking about?
I think so. I think it's a matter of emphasis. When I speak on this topic, I try to point out that there are different approaches to sharing one's message and one's faith. One is kind of a boundary maintenance approach where you're concerned about defining the boundaries, and therefore the next question is who's in and who's out. And I think the creeds play a part of that. And every religious institution needs to have its defining boundaries. What are we about? Doctrinally, ethically, and so on. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't have those boundaries and those concerns. However, that only gets you so far. What that really does is it speaks to the individuals within your religious culture. When you want to go outside and engage the other, whether for just dialogue or even sharing your faith, you really need a centered set approach. And that is, we still have boundaries, but we're more concerned about what defines the center. And for Christianity, that is Jesus Christ. And what we want to do through our dialogue and relationships and so on is move people closer to the center and not put so much emphasis on the boundaries and who's in and who's out. So it's a very different kind of approach. And I think you're seeing more of a balance within evangelicalism amongst younger evangelicals.
Can I just add a note about creedalism too? Because, as a Mormon who has attended Methodist church services, Episcopal church services at different times over her, you know, spiritual life, I don't think many Mormons understand the role creedalism plays in terms of worship in many mainline Protestant churches. And I know we're not speaking exclusively about mainline Protestantism here, but that, you know, the creed is recited, and it's recited in common across different what we would appear to us to be denominations of the mainline Christian tradition. And that whether or not people are able to own with real specificity particulars, for example, about Trinitarianism, and fully understand what their own creed holds, that ritual performance, that, you know, that of a common Christian ancestry is an important part of Protestant identity. That's not something we participate in at all as Mormons. And, you know, and we have to own that. And we have to own that we do lose out on expression of commonality with the rest of Christianity by not tracing our genealogy, you know, through this Orthodox line of descent. And anyone who's tried to have a substantive conversation with someone who is, you know, well-versed and well-read in Protestantism, you know, out of a desire for commonality, knows that there's just books we Mormons haven't read because we've been so busy reading all the Mormon stuff. You know, there's just parts of this shared Christianity we can't really own because we do have our own distinct history. And so there's some candid, you know, we have to be candid about that as well, that as Mormons we elect not to participate in this commonality of tradition.
Which, and if I can interject really quickly here, as much as I appreciate and think the forms of our interreligious dialogue between Mormons and evangelicals needs to continue, I would like to see the interjection of change. In that, in my view, Mormons have come closer to Protestantism to meet us in dialogue than we have gone towards them. The focus of the dialogue has tended to be upon certain doctrines that are of great interest to evangelicals, whereas my understanding of Mormonism is it's not primarily doctrine-oriented. And I would like to see evangelicals walk a little closer towards you folks as a religious culture in terms of what's important to you and a dialogue with you over your cultural issues.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, very cool.
Hey, come on over.
Yes.
John does great. About a year and a half ago, John, I attended a meeting in somebody's house in your neighborhood with Mormons in it and evangelicals. And it was a really fun and spirited discussion. But these were not, you know, well-trained theological folks for the most part. And it was very, very interesting to just sort of see the Mormons are saying, why is it that you think that we worship a different Jesus than you? If we call ourselves Christians, why won't you call us Christians? Why are you all hung up on saying, you know, it's not the same Christ? And, you know, on the other hand, they weren't able to sort of see, well, you know, you don't really misthink we're Christian because you won't accept our baptisms just like we won't accept your baptisms. And it was just this sort of level of confusion on the Mormon side, especially, I think, about why there was these distinctions. So do you mind going for just a second on that issue? Because I know I just hear it more when I come out there. How could they say that we worship a different Jesus? Where does that emerge from within the mentality of the evangelical Christian? They would only want to keep pushing that.
Well, I think they look at the various doctrinal statements and beliefs about Christ and the different religious traditions, and they see something very different. And of course, in part, that goes back to our Trinitarian beliefs, whereas you have something very different in terms of your understanding of the Godhead. So there is a looking at it in terms of doctrinal distinctives between the two religious traditions. Now, I think if you step back from that, I think we both historically are tracing our faith to the same historical person. However, our understanding of that person, who he was and what he did and all of that is very different. So in one sense, I think it's accurate to say we have the same Christ historically, but in another sense, doctrinally and perhaps in terms of philosophical theology, it's very different. So,
yeah, I get that. Okay, so, but if you just say, okay, we both are going to claim resurrection, we're both going to claim that something happened that we'll call the atonement that was, you know, needed to happen for us to you know, be transformed or to be, you know, caught up and you know, I don't want to, there's nuances of, you know,
right,
and Christ's work. You know. Anyway, so the atonement and the resurrection should be enough, at least for most Mormons, I would think, to say, oh, so if you're saying I'm worshiping a different Jesus, I'm still worshiping the one that was resurrected. I'm still worshiping the one that I have to gain my salvation through, you know, establishing some sort of relationship with. So why does the rest matter? Why can't we all, why don't they want to go with the minimalist, you know, that's enough to.
Can I jump in here?
Please.
Well, Dan, I think you're right, except that we didn't stop there. we didn't stop with the Jesus who was crucified and resurrected. We added on a Jesus who visited the New World, who is still breaking into history as recently as the 19th century. And that is the scandalon. That is the crux of the matter. We can't simply take the things that we have in common and say, why can't we get along?
I think one of the mistakes is either looking solely or largely at the similarities or solely or largely at the disagreements. I think we have to look at the broader picture. We have to look at this holistically and recognize there are common elements between the evangelical tradition and Mormonism, and yet there are also significant disagreements, and it is that overall picture of disagreement all the way to the point of major worldview differences, which is what concerns so many evangelicals.
I mean, part of this is just part of the, I think, a consequence of the boldness of adopting a restorationist viewpoint. I mean, we basically, as Mormons, you know, theologically discredit or step away from everything that happened between the early church and the 19th century. We sort of disown that and don't engage with a significant body of very dedicated theology and devotion by Christians worldwide. And one of the consequences of that, you know, restorationist viewpoint is that, you know, in terms of intellectual genealogy, it does look like we don't subscribe to the same Jesus if you trace it as a line of descent.
Good. So let me say one thing, and then I want to pick up right exactly where you were, Joanna. I guess, John, my reason for starting that little bit about the different Jesuses, somehow it seems to me like it's just served as a quick and easy way to dismiss. Oh, well, you just, you know, it, without any real thinking. So I was glad for you to articulate, and Joanna to jump in there with some extra things that do that, because I just see it as, you know, oh, that's racist or that's homophobic, as just some sort of way of avoiding conversation, you know, to really take it to the next level. And so that's how I've sort of seen that one functioning a lot of times, and I'm glad to have a little exploration of that. So, Joanna, please go ahead, please.
Sola scriptura.
Okay, yeah, do that for a second.
Uh-huh. Not necessarily now, but at some point. So
no, do it now, because I'm going to take us more into cultural attitudes here in a sec. So please.
Okay, so I think another issue, as I raised before, is this difference between sola fide among Protestants, sola scriptura. With the sola fide, one of my frustrations has been when I hear evangelicals claim that Mormons believe we are saved by works. I think if you conducted a straw poll of Mormons and asked them, do you believe that your own good deeds are going to save you? They will say, no, I'm saved because of the atonement of the Savior. And so it's very frustrating. But I do think that in Mormonism, works are not irrelevant. Works help to deepen us in the faith that saves us. That is the crux of the matter. And so when I hear this, you know, very crass caricature of Mormons being saved by works or believing in salvation by works, I wish that we could nuance that some more, even within Mormonism, because I don't know that that connection is as well explained as it ought to be.
Yeah, I think evangelicals are pleased when they hear that kind of view, and I do think in our dialogues we don't do a whole lot of nuancing at all. I think also Latter-day Saints need to hear that there is a place for works within evangelicalism. Although we believe that God gives us the gift of faith and that he regenerates us and gives us salvation, nevertheless, that doesn't mean that we have this freedom to sin at will. Rather, we're called to obedience and to be transformed into the image of Christ through the works that we do, and that we proclaim the kingdom through our works and so on. So I think many times there's also a corresponding misunderstanding and caricature in Mormonism that there's no valid place for works in the evangelical understanding of things.
Right.
All right. Thank you guys. This is fascinating to me, and I want to kind of pick up on something that Joanna was talking about a minute ago and use that as a transition into just sort of a more of a felt character of the two traditions, sort of the more subtle ways that evangelicals may view Mormonism, the way that Mormons in some ways contribute to their own suspicion on those parts and things like that. And maybe the first one is this one that Joanna kind of brought to my attention again. And this, I wanted to again thank our listener, Michael Todd, for he and I had a 90-minute conversation about a week ago, and he kind of re-alerted me to some of these different strains. But one of the things is he talks about there's this sense of a Mormon hubris that we, like you were saying, Jana, we've chopped out everything from, you know, the first century to the 19th century and just sort of let it all go. And one of the things that he re-highlighted for me is this view of a restoration as somewhat being just a challenge to the sovereignty of God. You know, this idea that God is powerful enough, he should be able to run things without humans and their frailties thwarting his work for all these centuries and whatnot, so that there would need to be a restoration that would come back. Are you following me there a little bit? Yeah, so this is this idea that you guys are basically even saying that God wasn't powerful enough to keep his church around here, not only once, you know, back in the Old Testament times that God was working his way that he had to, you know, do it, but now he wasn't powerful enough again. And so he was just kind of highlighting to me that that's just sort of a thing. I know I hardly would ever think about that as an arrogant piece.
You know, and it may be a mischaracterization of the restoration moment. You know, when we talk about the restoration is a word that Mormons have tried to brand for ourselves, but there is a historical movement in the early 19th century of restorationist churches, and Mormonism is not the only one. Even churches in the Latter-day Saint movement, broadly considered, these are not the only ones. Disciples of Christ are a restorationist movement. You know, and they're all characterized by a reaction to the professionalization of theological discourse and highly fragmented and sectarian theological contests among different closely related branches of Protestantism. And so, you know, viewed that way, then it reminds me of what John is saying about his desire in evangelicalism to, you know, not lose sight of, and I'm forgetting the phrase you've used, John, but it's a good one, but the fundamentals, you know, what really matters, the centering parts of the discourse, rather than looking at the margins and the most technical abstruse points of differentiation. And that was what the restorationist movement was about. But that restorationist movement did happen largely among fairly lesser educated people, strongly centered on the American frontier. And there was a sort of opportunism there to not be accountable to, you know, hundreds of years of careful theological work by scholars. And as someone, you know, who is a scholar, you know, it now I think that we do need to be more humble in the way we think about the restoration, realize that there is a debt owed if we do plan to claim a common Christian tradition to all of the people who have contributed to that tradition over the millennia.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the church is doing a decent job, at least, of acknowledging, you know, the different people that helped bring the translation of the Bible. You know, we're celebrating King James, you know, right now. And so we're getting a lot of honoring of different people. And we've done pretty good with, you know, some Calvin and Lutheran as, people preparing the way eventually for Joseph Smith and all that. But it's still within our sacred narrative, you know, rather than on its own terms and stuff. But anyway, so just that little bit of, you know, we do have sort of this arrogance and this hubris that I think we need to watch and sort of understand. So John, is that like at least you're hearing it out there somewhat? Is your sense that there is this gut reaction about Mormon arrogance or hubris?
Well, I think so. I think it's troubling for a lot of evangelicals to feel slighted that we jump over centuries of what we would consider Christian history. And then Joseph Smith, you know, received this restoration and the rest of us are left out in the cold of apostasy. So, to whatever extent that earlier Christian history can be reassessed and perhaps viewed more positively by Mormonism, I think that would be helpful.
Cool. Now, another piece that I wanted to bring in is, and this will be, again, just sort of a wider worldview that maybe a lot of Mormons, I don't know, we should be able to live within this idea of the forces of good and evil and the forces, you know, of God and Satan fighting themselves out here in the midst of the world. But there's a sense among, I don't know, you're not going to get it too much at least most of the main university, the mainline Christian universities too much. But isn't there a sense, John, of Mormonism is somehow tinged with feelings of the occult or devilish influence through masonry, through the secrecy of its temple rites, through the money digging that Joseph Smith was involved with. Does that sort of add to a suspicion of Mormonism, at least kind of in that, I don't know, I don't want to say just the rural churches, but the sort of the ones that are maybe not playing at the same level of theological, you know, they're not focusing on theology so much as they are on the powers of good and evil in the world?
I think that's part of it. I think it's a minor part. I do think that the doctrinal concerns are the major ones. However, for some evangelicals, there is this concern over what they would see the occult or esotericism playing a part in early Mormon history and perhaps continuing on into temple rituals and so on. And as they, I think they have something of a simplistic understanding of the Western esoteric tradition in general, and they tend to label it all as evil as in broadly as the occult. So there's a need for more depth in terms of looking at that tradition. And also to the extent at which it may or may not play a part in contemporary Mormonism, but I do think that does add a particularly negative tinge for some evangelicals.
I think that any religion that has secrecy at its core, and you know, Mormons can prevaricate all we want to and say, oh, it's sacred, not secret.
That's right.
It's secret. If you mm-hmm. can't talk about it outside the temple, that is secret, and mm-hmm. calling it something else is not helpful. That sermon's over.
Well, Joanna, you went exactly where I was going to go there about secrecy, so it was neat to hear you and Joanna both jump in. We're all on the same page. So, hey, I want to bring this to a close. Respect your time and the listener's time again. Is there anything that was like something that you really wanted to share in this discussion, an insight that you weren't able to articulate? Why don't I start with Joanna, and we'll go to Jana and John. Just something that may have been missing. Joanna, anything you wanted to bring up or emphasize again?
No, I really appreciate John being with us. I think, again, you know, productive conversation in which neither Mormons nor evangelicals resort to, you know, caricatures, and in which we're forthcoming about the limitations of our own respective approaches to interfaith dialogue is just crucial. And I really appreciate the time John's taken to be with us.
Woohoo!
And I'll piggyback on that. Thank you for the opportunity. I just want to reiterate that I think, again, there is something of a change, a shift going on in at least some segments of evangelicalism. The willingness to look beyond groups like Mormonism as a cult and instead view it as a religious culture and therefore move away from things like problematic films of the past and holding up sacred garments and that type of thing, even though you still see vestiges of that, unfortunately. At General Conference and at the Manti Miracle Pageant and those kinds of things. But again, I think that segment of evangelicalism is waning. And mm-hmm. I am happy and proud to be a part of a new generation of evangelicals that is saying, hey, if we really care about these people, this is not the way to gain their respect, their friendship, and to gain a hearing. And we need to be willing to listen and to be self-critical and develop relationships, not only as a means of persuading, but simply to make this a better place in which to live in spite of our religious differences.
Great. And Jana?
Well, I think, you know, Joanna opened up by telling a bit of her personal history about being on the receiving end of some anti-Mormon silliness. And it is an experience I think a lot of Mormons have had. Happily, because I didn't convert until I was an adult, I was maybe a little more able to handle it than some of the youth I see at my church who, like Joanna, go to a fireside or something with their church and then come home crying because the religion that they know and love has been so falsely represented. And so I really believe what John is saying is true. I think that we've seen a new dawn. I'm particularly thrilled to see some of the stuff that we're seeing out of the emergent wing of evangelical Christianity. I read a lot of those books and think they're absolutely wonderful. And I look forward to continuing to be a bridge builder. I hope that we can continue to do that important work.
Yeah, and I was reminded a little bit when you were saying that, John, and now Jana too, like Rob Bell's book has really now started a great conversation among evangelical Christians, right? Rob, Jana, you might be able to say it better. I know you blogged about his book, but he's basically questioning. He says, let's revisit the doctrine of hell, right?
Mm-hmm.
And things like that, yeah.
Fascinating book. I think a lot of Mormons ought to read it, frankly.
You know, and Dan, if I can just emphasize with a pitch for Mormon Matters, you know, I mean, Mormons have a responsibility to be forthright and candid in our conversations with evangelicals and in the way we think amongst ourselves. It's not enough for us to say, why do they pick on us? We believe in the same Jesus. We need to think about what Jan is representing, the way we relate to mainline and evangelical Christianity, and candidly about the intellectual rigor and the emotional soundness of our own positions. And it's places like this podcast where this is happening in the Mormon world. So if you believe in Dan and dialogue, you should consider becoming a subscriber to this podcast, even just for a couple bucks a month. Okay, I'm done, Dan.
Hey, you're too cool. And I actually had a couple people at this conference this week that said, Joanna is working us. I'm now going to subscribe. So I appreciate your good efforts for that. This podcast is a piece of my family's financial puzzle. It was interesting. I worked for a group that sort of lost its funding, and so now I'm just working different projects. And this isn't a big piece that we count on, but we certainly are grateful for any donations that come, or if you want a monthly subscribe, you can do that at mormonmatters.org. So thank you everyone for that, and Joanna, you're so funny, you're always pushing me to push harder for some donations, so I appreciate that.
Dan is modest to a fault.
I'm going in the poorhouse. No.
Pepsi.
There you go. Anyway, I won't tell that story. But hey, thank you guys. You have been fantastic. I love just the open-heartedness and the lack of defensiveness that these kinds of discussions bring. John couldn't have asked for a more gracious guest and a wonderful articulator of these positions, and I want to continue working with you whenever the chance arises, and I wish you all the best as you move on to your different projects.
Great, I appreciate it, and I look forward to continued cooperation through the Foundation for Religious Diplomacy.
Cool, we can't wait. You're a member of the chapter founders for the evangelical group of that organization. And then Jana and Joanna, as always, you're just two of my favorite people who just make me, you know, it's like, how do I even get to associate with such smart, fun people? And I really appreciate all the gifts that you share and that you're sharing them with our listeners. And I invite all three of you, please, to visit the blog. That there's been some pretty good conversations emerging for all these different podcast episodes. And so I hope you'll visit from time to time and contribute to that discussion as we go. So I'll share with you when I release. It should release on Tuesday evening, the 14th. So talk to you guys later. Thank you very much for being part of this.
Thank you, Dan.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.